Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Super Tuesday is tomorrow, a critical day for the Democrats running for president, and we will get to that. But first, the global death toll of the novel coronavirus is now more than 3,000, including two in Washington state. There are at least 88 cases in the United States and almost 90,000 infections worldwide on every continent except Antarctica. Joining us now is Kathleen Sebelius, who served as the Secretary of Health and Human Services during the Obama administration. Secretary Sebelius, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
And what are your biggest concerns right now when it comes to COVID-19, the new coronavirus?
Well, I'd say the number one concern is to instill some confidence in the American public that they are getting accurate, scientifically based information and not political spin. And I would hope that we would let the scientists, people like Tony Fauci, a world-renowned expert who's sitting at NIH, who will be leading the vaccine development, and the folks at CDC, I work closely with Dr. Ann Schuchat, and she's fabulous. But let the scientists do the talking on a regular basis, tell the American people what we know and what we don't know. That's step one. It does seem we are behind the curve on testing. Now that the disease is presenting with some ferocity in places outside of China, I would think we'd want to update the testing protocol about who gets tested, when they get tested, visitors coming from a whole variety of areas, Americans who have traveled to those areas. Getting ahead of this disease means testing and then isolating as quickly as possible.
Is it possible at this point to control the spread of this virus, since it has reached so many places and in many people there are no symptoms? It's hard to tell who has it and who doesn't.
Well, I think we've lost, as some of the epidemiologists say, a couple of critical weeks. I still think there are containment strategies that work pretty well. What we know is that most people will have a very mild version, but also it can spread very, very quickly. Anybody who's in the hospital right now for respiratory illnesses probably should be tested immediately. Healthcare workers, because, you know, you want to make sure we don't lose healthcare workers first and then have a real tragic situation. So catching up with the testing, but also getting state and local governments prepared. We need to look at hospital surges. We need to put in place plans. And most hospitals have this and have drilled on this, but I know there have been really serious cuts in preparation money, serious cuts in the CDC, which is often the backbone of state and local government health funding.
You know, we've been talking to people who are canceling trips that they were planning to take because of this. There was a huge convention of 11,000 physicists from around the world that was supposed to happen this week in Denver. They just canceled it at the last minute. Some of those people were coming from China, but I think there's just a general concern. Do you think that it's rational for people to be staying away from conventions, to stay off of airplanes, not travel, things like that?
Well, I'm in about an hour going to the airport to get on an airplane. So I am very carefully monitoring what is going on. Right now, the presentation in the United States is very low, and I think it's really important, again, for people to pay attention to the updated guidance. The CDC website is very good, but I do think continuing to do, you know, business as usual makes good sense. Decisions about things like closing school and teleworking and should be put in place. Plans should be put in place. But all of those have real downsides as well as possible protective sides. And I think they need to be dealt with very, very cautiously. We don't want, you know, millions of workers to suddenly not have a paycheck and not be able to support themselves. We don't want kids to be roaming around the streets because they're not in school and they don't have breakfast and lunch fed to them. I mean, there are some really important safety and security issues that come with preemptive decisions that may not be scientifically driven. The other thing I think, Jeremy, that's really important for people to understand, the likely path of this disease is a big spurt in the spring. And as it gets hotter in the summertime, the disease is likely to recede a bit, but it will come back in the fall.
Let me ask you one more question. You're obviously the former governor of Kansas, the former governor of Indiana, now Vice President Mike Pence has been put in charge of this crisis. And when he was governor of Indiana, he was criticized for how he handled an HIV outbreak because at first he didn't want to allow a needle exchange program. And it is thought that that made the situation much worse before he finally did accept a needle exchange program. Do you have confidence in Mike Pence to handle the coronavirus outbreak for the White House?
What I've seen so far out of the administration, and I would distinguish the administration from the experts in government, the administration has done everything possible to deny and confuse the public about the severity of this situation and about what is going on right now. I also worry about this administration's pattern of firing people who have opinions or make statements or bring information that is not seen as politically advantageous. Nothing could be more dangerous.
That is Kathleen Sebelius, who was the Secretary of Health and Human Services during the Obama administration. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to talk to you, Jeremy.
Well, let's get more now on the situation in Washington state, where two people have died from the new coronavirus. More cases have also been confirmed over the last couple of days. Joining us now is Will Stone, a reporter at KNKX in Seattle. Hi, Will.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, Will, what more do we know about the people who died?
What we know is that the first death was a man in his 50s who had a number of underlying health problems, and it was one of the things that prompted the hospital to test him because he had an unexplained respiratory condition and they knew he was at significant risk. There's no indication he had a connection to the second death, which we learned about last night. That was an elderly resident of a nursing care facility east of Seattle who also had underlying health conditions, and he was in his 70s. At the moment, it doesn't appear there was any connection between these two deaths.
Okay. So since Friday, we know the number of cases has jumped significantly, and a lot of them have been linked to that nursing facility in King County. They include residents of the facility and healthcare workers. What more do we know about those cases?
That's right. There's been a cluster of cases that we've learned about over the weekend, including one healthcare worker who was there and has been tested positive. Last night, we learned there are three people who are in critical condition at the hospital nearby. All are in their 70s or older and have underlying conditions. And we are waiting to hear about a number of other tests. We know that quite a few people there are presenting symptoms. The CDC is on the ground right there helping to investigate that outbreak.
We're also hearing some schools are closed today. What other things are public health officials doing to respond to this cluster?
Public health officials have been very aggressive with their messaging, and they've really taken on a massive mobilization of public health resources. There's just a lot of information coming at people right now that's evolving hour by hour, and public health is really just putting a lot of messaging out to the public, not to panic, but to also take proper measures and make sure if there's any risk that they could be exposed, that they contact health authorities as quickly as possible.
I'm wondering about concerns over testing protocols there. We've been hearing about that in other states. What are you hearing about the testing process?
What we do know is that because of delays in testing and the ability for states to run the tests themselves instead of sending them to the CDC, we did not learn about all these cases perhaps as soon as we could have. But at the moment, the state lab is able to run tests. They have assured us that they do have the capacity to test all the people who need it, but that may change, and they are working with a number of commercial laboratories and other places. So if there is a need to run more tests, they can do it. It's also helped that the testing criteria has broadened, so people with unexplained respiratory conditions can now get tested, even if there's no indication they had travel history. Of course, we're learning of a number of people now in the community who have no known link to an affected region who are testing positive.
I'm just wondering about that messaging now that the testing has been opened up to everyone who might be exhibiting symptoms. How are medical facilities, hospitals in that greater Seattle area responding to it? Are they seeing an influx of folks who want to be tested? What's it like there right now?
I think that the hospitals all are under quite a bit of pressure with the public, and they've assured everyone that they will run tests on anyone who really seems at all at risk. But there will be a point, perhaps, where there'll be widespread transmission, and being able to test everyone and chase down every case will not be feasible. And at that point, we may see more dramatic measures in terms of canceling events here and other things, just because they won't be able to do this kind of disease investigation that they have been doing with these cases up till now.
Will Stone is a reporter at KNKX in Seattle. Will, thank you so much for this update.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Indeed. Are you hiring? With Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started today at Indeed.com/here now.
We are just a day away from Super Tuesday, and the field of Democratic presidential candidates vying for the more than 1,300 delegates tomorrow has narrowed. Billionaire Tom Steyer dropped out. So did former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He won Iowa, but after coming far behind other candidates in South Carolina, he said yesterday he could not see a path forward for his campaign.
In a divided nation, we saw fellow Democrats join with independents and, yes, some of those future former Republicans to choose a different politics, to choose a politics defined not by who we push away, but by how many we can call to our side. And we sent a message to every kid out there wondering if whatever marks them out as different means they are somehow destined to be less than. To see that someone who once felt that exact same way can become a leading American presidential candidate with his husband at his side.
The conventional wisdom is that Buttigieg's exit from the race is good news for Joe Biden ahead of all the voting that will happen tomorrow. Biden got almost 50% of the vote in South Carolina, with Senator Bernie Sanders coming in a distant second place with about 20%. Joining us now is Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio, who is a Biden supporter. Congressman, welcome. And what is your reaction, first of all, to Mayor Buttigieg dropping out of the race?
Well, I think it was a really smart move and a courageous move. You know, it's never easy to put so much time and effort in for such a long period of time and then have to get out. But I think it's a signal that the moderate to liberal lane is consolidating around Joe Biden. And I think the writing's on the wall for that. When you saw the huge African-American support he got in South Carolina and just, you know, winning by almost 30 points. And a lot of other candidates not able to get support in the African-American community, which is a huge part of the Democratic primary moving forward. So I think it's a great sign for Joe Biden. And, you know, hopefully we can just keep it rolling.
Was a deal made between Biden and Buttigieg? Some people are wondering that today.
I don't think so, but I don't know that. You know, I think Mayor Pete, you know, is as sharp as it gets. And if he wants to be a part of helping this consolidation, I think a natural fit for him would be Vice President Biden, which would be a huge boost for Joe Biden moving forward. So, you know, we certainly would welcome Mayor Pete. He ran a fantastic campaign. He has a great team around him, and we would welcome his support.
Do you think that the presence in the race of Amy Klobuchar and Michael Bloomberg are going to hurt Joe Biden tomorrow?
Well, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, if Amy Klobuchar does really, really well in Minnesota, you know, those are delegates that she's going to get that, you know, maybe a Bernie Sanders wouldn't get, which would keep his numbers, you know, down a little bit. So I think her in the short term, given the next couple of days, it's not going to be unhelpful to have her in the race. I would say after that, and, you know, she's going to have to evaluate like I had to do and Mayor Pete had to do at some point, you know, whether or not you can make a realistic run at it. If she does get out of the race, I would think a lot of her supporters would go to Vice President Biden as well. And so you would begin the consolidation process. and then there'll be a, you know, sprint, you know, through March and April.
How is Joe Biden, if he becomes the nominee, going to win over supporters of Bernie Sanders in a way that Hillary Clinton clearly had some trouble with 4 years ago?
Well, I think Donald Trump has a way of sharpening the minds of progressives and Democrats. I don't think there's anybody in the Democratic field or even a Bernie Sanders supporter that doesn't think that Joe Biden, who passed the Violence Against Women's Act, who helped President Obama, you know, secure the auto industry in the United States or provide universal health care for everybody in the United States, isn't leaps and bounds better on policy than Donald Trump has been, or on the environment. I mean, you know, the argument is really going to shift because it's going to be, okay, you know, the worst thing you could possibly do if you're interested in climate change is have Donald Trump be president for another 4 years. You know, the worst thing you could do for women's rights or human rights or the new economy would be to have Donald Trump in office for another 4 years talking about, you know, chasing smokestacks and going back to 1950. Joe Biden understands the new economy. He's been very progressive on a lot of these issues, but he has the working class sensibility. So I think those Bernie Sanders voters, while they may not like it because they're, you know, they like their candidate and they like him a lot. But I think at the end of the day, staring at the prospects of Donald Trump getting another 4 years, nominating people to the Supreme Court, rolling back environmental regulations, privatizing public schools, government schools, as he likes to call them, I think the Sanders voters are going to know what the right thing to do is for the country.
What is success going to look like tomorrow?
Well, you know, obviously there's a lot of states. So, you know, we're not sure exactly what it looks like or, you know, what the map looks like tomorrow. But, you know, he's got to have a number of successes. There's no question about that. And I think Mayor Pete getting out also helps. But I think the more successful he is tomorrow, you know, the better chance of maybe a Michael Bloomberg getting out down the road or somebody, you know, Amy Klobuchar getting out down the road. So I don't know what it looks like. You've got to have some significant wins, and I think he will. And then, you know, we'll wake up on Wednesday morning and see, you know, what the next steps are.
That is Tim Ryan, a Democratic congressman from Ohio, supporting Joe Biden for president. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow also marks the first time that another candidate will appear on the ballot. That would be former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. For more on Bloomberg's campaign, we're joined by Antonio Villaraigosa, who was the mayor of Los Angeles from 2005 to 2013 and is supporting Bloomberg for president. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
What do you think the result of your fellow former mayor Pete Buttigieg getting out of the race will be?
Well, I have a lot of respect for Pete. I think he surprised everyone, went beyond anyone's expectations. I think he saw that there was no path ahead. And like so many of us, he's willing to do whatever he can to beat Donald Trump. And on that note, we're all in the same boat.
So Super Tuesday is the first time Michael Bloomberg is going to be on the ballot. What does he have to do tomorrow to have a path forward toward the White House?
I think he has to continue to show progress. I expect that we're going to show very well in a number of states. We've thought that from the beginning. There's a reason why in those debates everybody ganged up on him. He was the candidate who was on the ascendancy. And so I expect that we'll see more of that tomorrow.
But a lot of people thought that he didn't perform up to expectations in those debates. Do you think that he hurts other moderate candidates, like, let's say, Joe Biden, by staying in the race?
Absolutely not. The fact of the matter is, those who thought he didn't do as well as he could have understand that they had a year on him of debates, I think 8 debates before that. He got better in the second one. I think you'll see he'll get better still going forward. He got in the race late, in no small part, because most of the candidates didn't seem to be getting traction. And because he's got a track record and a plan for the future.
What do you think that he can bring to the presidency that Joe Biden cannot?
Well, one of the things I think he brings is the resources. This is going to be a tough race. Donald Trump has already raised somewhere around $200+ million. The expectation is that he's going to raise a lot more. We need somebody that can take them on in all 50 states. Someone like Michael Bloomberg, who's committed to support whoever the nominee is and keep those offices in the battleground states open and fully staffed.
You are from California, obviously. You represented Los Angeles as the mayor for many years. Why do you think Bernie Sanders is doing so well there, so much better than the other candidates in the polls?
Well, he's doing really well among young people. He's doing really well, you know, among Latinos, in no small part because the population is much younger. He's doing really well because he's campaigned before and had a large operation in California, and he's doing really well because he's argued that everything should be free, college, you know, medical care, to the tune of some $90 trillion. Last time I looked, we don't have the wherewithal to spend $90 trillion, but certainly he is doing well.
Finally, Mayor, let me just ask you, are you happy California is going this early in the primary process? Do you think that it achieved what Democrats were hoping for when they pushed it up on the calendar?
Yeah, I am happy. I mean, look, we've been an ATM for the longest time. They come over, they raise money in California. We're a donor state and have been for a very, very long time. And, you know, not much campaigning in our state. And so it's great to see that the candidates, and particularly Michael, who's been to California more than any of the other candidates, and I think people appreciate that. They want to play a role in who's going to be the next president. And as you know, it's a state that is very strongly opposed to the policies of Donald Trump, the divisiveness of Donald Trump, and are going to support a candidate who they ultimately think can beat him.
That is Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles, who is supporting Michael Bloomberg for president. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And elsewhere in the show today, we are speaking with Congressman Ro Khanna, who's a supporter of Bernie Sanders' campaign for president. Tomorrow will be the big day, of course, but if you missed that conversation on air, you can hear it at hereandnow.org. And if you go to hereandnow.org, you can also hear our interviews with almost all of the presidential candidates.
Don't you feel better when you're prepared? Well, with the spread of the coronavirus, this is a good time to make a plan. I'm Allison Aubrey. NPR's Life Kit has a whole episode on what steps you can take to protect your family. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
As if flying was not stressful enough, there are now new challenges for parents flying with young children. The problem stems from economy fares that don't allow seat selection, and the result is that young kids are sometimes being seated on their own. A petition by Consumer Reports is taking on the issue. They've gathered more than 123,000 signatures from angry parents. Anna Layton is with Consumer Reports. A member of her team will testify tomorrow before the House Subcommittee on Aviation. And Anna, can you start by describing the problem?
We did some work last year where we started asking families to submit complaints to the Department of Transportation. And people, by basic economy, understanding that at this low price, they can't pick their seats, but it doesn't occur to them that that means they'll actually be seated in a completely different part of the plane than their children.
And you've heard stories from parents all around the country. What are some of the things you've heard?
We've heard from people whose babies were seated two rows, three rows away from them, who have small children who were scared. And the airline says there's nothing we can do. They go to the gate agent who says there's nothing we can do. They get on the airline, the flight attendants don't help.
I know this because I'm a parent. So what happens often is that the person who bought the ticket, the parent, is then forced to ask other passengers, can they switch seats with them?
Exactly. And with seat selection fees, the more fees we're charged to do each thing on the plane, the less likely it is that people want to switch.
And you say this is a safety issue. It's really not a matter of preference. I mean, obviously, when you have a baby or anyone under 10 years old seated without their parent, that is a safety issue.
Absolutely. And we all know that safety lecture we get at the beginning of the flight. Take care of yourself before your kids. There has to be a responsible adult there. I think about if there's an evacuation and my child is seated 10 rows behind me. Am I going to calmly exit the plane or am I going to disrupt the entire evacuation by going back and making sure my child is okay?
Your colleague is testifying tomorrow before the House Subcommittee on Aviation. What do you hope will happen?
So 4 years ago, Congress directed the Department of Transportation to look into this and, if appropriate, issue a rule requiring airlines to let families sit next to each other with no extra charge. Department of Transportation decided not to do anything about it. So what I'm hoping is that at this hearing tomorrow, the members will hear that the Department of Transportation did not follow up on what they had directed. We also are sending letters today to the three major airlines, calling them on them to do this themselves.
Have you gotten any reaction from the airlines on your petition or the push for them to change this rule?
Delta says they are doing a lot and they're fixing it on a case-by-case basis. American Airlines actually has a great policy on their website that says children 15 and under will be seated with an adult on their ticket. And United says don't buy basic economy if you want to sit with your kids. But none of these policies are working to actually ensure that this isn't happening.
You know, I'm just wondering, in the meantime, do you have advice for families who are traveling but can't afford to then just buy a higher priced premium price ticket?
Parents just don't imagine a scenario where buying a basic economy ticket will risk their 3-year-old, 4-year-old sitting 10 rows away from them. Yeah. So the best advice we can give families is buy a ticket you can afford, reach out to the airline, make the case to the airline reps everywhere you can, and look at the websites. American Airlines' website has a lot of advice about how to ensure you're seated together. And then if something happens, please let us know. Complain to the airline, complain to the Department of Transportation.
That's Anna Layton, Director of Financial Policy on Consumer Reports Advocacy and Mobilization Team. Thank you so much for talking to us. We want to take some time now to answer some of your questions about COVID-19 and the coronavirus causing it. And to do that, we're joined by Dr. William Schaffner, professor at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's in Nashville. And Dr. Schaffner, welcome back to Here and Now.
Good to be with you, Tanya.
So we spoke a few weeks ago, and one question that we had early on and we still have from lots of our listeners is whether masks are effective in slowing the spread of the virus. They're selling out everywhere. What do we know about how it is transmitted, and is there any evidence that coronavirus is airborne?
Well, what we know about masks used in the community is that the data supporting that is scant. Could they have a small role in preventing the transmission of the virus? I suppose so. One of the things they do is prevent you from actually touching your nose and your mouth, which might interrupt transmission if you happen to pick it up on your fingertips. But the use of masks is more a comfort and a sign to others that you're doing your best rather than an actual prevention of getting the coronavirus or influenza, for that matter.
We've heard, though, it might be a little more effective for those who are sick versus you using it to prevent yourself from being sick. What's the science on that?
Yes, that would be correct. And we would then recommend that to be used within the home. It's not a license for sick people to go out and about, which a lot of people misinterpret.
Okay, let's get to some of our questions from our audience. Petra in Portland, Oregon asks, how long can the COVID-19 virus survive in the environment? Would transmission of the virus be possible via contact with goods produced in an endemic area?
We think that that risk is very, very low because the virus can survive for a period of hours, but then it just dies off because that's not a comfortable environment for the virus. And the way to protect oneself from potential environmental contamination just round and about is lots of good hand hygiene. Mm-hmm. Wash those hands, use those wipes and gels, and that's the way to protect yourself.
Another question sort of related to all of this is about climate. Do we know about whether the virus can live in warmer climates, or is it more susceptible to folks in colder climates? This is an interesting question because we know that the flu and the cold often comes during the wintertime, but that's not necessarily because of the temperature. Is that correct?
Well, we don't exactly know why influenza and common colds are so seasonal, but they are. And there has been a hope that the coronavirus will have read the textbook and will know what to do and kind of go away once the weather gets a bit warmer. But we don't know that this novel coronavirus, new in humans, will do that.
Here's a question from Don in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Don asks, if you get it and recover, are you then immune to getting it again?
You know, Don, that's a very, very interesting question. The normal human coronaviruses give us some protection for a period of time, and then over a period of months and years, that protection wanes and we can get reinfected. So this is a new coronavirus. Will it follow that pattern, or will it give us durable protection for a long period of time, akin to measles? We don't know the answer to that yet.
And we are seeing reports, specifically one person who had coronavirus, was treated for it in a hospital, and then went back into the general public and got it again. So I think that is also where this question is coming from. And I guess your answer to that is, we just don't know right now.
Yeah, I'm afraid, Tanya, we just don't know. And was that a biological fluke, one in a million? Or is that a phenomenon that could repeat itself more frequently? We'll try to study that and find out.
Yeah. Jonathan from San Carlos, California, is a preschool teacher, and he wants to know if there are any particular risks or precautions recommended for children and pregnant women. What about that? Are they more at risk?
Well, actually, Jonathan, one of the most provocative aspects, epidemiologic features of the coronavirus outbreak is that children are remarkably spared. Not 100%, but you don't see many, many ill children in China, for example. And so this is a peculiarity of the virus that we haven't yet really understood. The recommendations regarding children and pregnant women are the same as for all of us. Lots of good hand hygiene, avoid people who are coughing and sneezing, and pay attention to what your local health department is saying about the risk in your particular neighborhood. We'll find out more about that as we test more broadly around the country in the next couple of weeks.
Joel from Massachusetts wants to know, I think this is a question a lot of folks have, what is the most up-to-date status globally for producing an effective COVID-19 vaccine?
People are working on this in a number of venues, the National Institutes of Health, any number of vaccine manufacturers, both in this country and abroad. But we shouldn't get our hopes up for the near term. Developing a vaccine that is demonstrably safe and likely to be effective will take months, probably a year or longer. We certainly don't want to give a vaccine that's either unsafe or doesn't work. It will take time to determine that.
Yeah, some ways away. Here's an interesting question about other forms of vaccines for pneumonia and meningitis, for example. Cindy wonders if getting the vaccine for pneumonia does any good to defend against coronavirus.
The vaccine against pneumonia might provide some protection against the complication of pneumonia, which, of course, accompanies coronavirus. And now, we're going to get into the weeds here a little bit. Actually, as I read the early clinical data, it looks as though the virus itself is causing most of the pneumonias rather than a complicating bacterial infection against which the pneumonia vaccine would give us protection.
Okay. Okay, this is a question that I have too. So Alec in Silver Spring, Maryland has a question about underlining health conditions. It's something that many people also ask us. He writes, does having asthma make me more at risk? Do we have any data on what conditions make one more susceptible to the severe infection?
Yeah, Alex, we're beginning to learn about that. The Chinese experience is telling us that, first of all, advancing age is a disadvantage. The older you get, the more likely you are to have a severe infection. And, of course, as we age, we pick up underlying illnesses, diseases of the heart, the lung, diabetes, and the like. I cannot tell you specifically about asthma. And, of course, in China, it's a much more polluted environment than we have here. And many people, particularly men, smoke. So in China, there may be many persons who have an underlying lung disease, so the lung can't respond as well, is more susceptible to severity.
Okay. Travel. Many people asked if they should cancel their vacations or other travel they have coming up, especially overseas. What do you say?
Tanya, it's been the most frequently asked question, at least has come to me, in the last week. It has a great deal to do with your risk tolerance. How nervous would it make you to either pick up a virus over there and be treated in one of those locations, or might there actually be travel barriers that are put up which would make it difficult for you to return home? Making those decisions is kind of dicey right at the moment, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Finally, I want to know from you, are there any misconceptions about this disease that you've heard that you want to dispel?
The one that's come up just recently is whether food could somehow be involved in the transmission of this virus. There's nothing to do with food and the transmission of this virus. You can put that thought aside.
That's Dr. William Schaffner, professor at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Schaffner, thanks so much for answering these questions.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And your questions and comments are welcome at hereandnow.org.
Many Democrats are concerned about the possibility of Bernie Sanders leading the ticket this November. Some have compared him to George McGovern, the South Dakota senator who became the Democratic Party's 1972 presidential nominee, only to be trounced by Richard Nixon in the general election. South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn, who endorsed Joe Biden, brought up McGovern's failed campaign in his interview with Here and Now's Tanya Mosley last week.
I was around in 1972, and that's what I see happen here today. History ought to be instructive. And I may be wrong about this. I hope I'm wrong. I just don't think I am.
Derek Thompson has been looking at the comparisons between McGovern and Sanders. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So you have a piece in The Atlantic with the headline, Bernie Sanders is George McGovern, though you see big differences between 1972 and today. Let's start with just a reminder about what happened in 72 and how McGovern became the Democratic nominee.
Well, let's start by listing all the ways that 2020 and 1972 are eerily familiar. In both years, an ethically dubious Republican is the president. In both years, the early frontrunner in the Democratic primary is a veteran East Coast senator. And in both years, the establishment favorite falters in the early primaries, and the anti-establishment left-wing senator takes over the frontrunner spot. So we know who these characters are in the 2020 version of the story. Trump is the president. Biden was the establishment frontrunner. Sanders is the insurgent. But all this was happening in 72. Nixon was the incumbent Republican president. For most of the Democratic primary in 72, the most likely challenger seemed to be the long-serving senator from Maine, Edmund Muskie. Muskie's downfall, however, provided an opening for one George McGovern, and that left-wing senator drew a lot of enthusiastic support from an ethnically diverse, younger crowd, a lot of newly enfranchised teenagers, and he won the Democratic nomination before, as we all know, getting trounced, as you said, by Nixon in November.
By the way, this brings me back to one of the greatest political books I've ever read, which was the Hunter Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, yep. 72, all about this campaign. Right. Here is McGovern accepting the Democratic nomination at the convention in 72, where he touted his plan to guarantee a job for adults.
A program to put America back to work demands that work be properly rewarded. That means the end of a system of economic controls in which labor is depressed, but prices and corporate profits run sky high. It means a system of national health insurance so that a worker can afford decent health care for himself and his family.
Sounds kind of familiar, Derek.
This is why I said in the headline of the article, Bernie Sanders is George McGovern. McGovern called health care a human right. He wanted as he said right here, a national health insurance system. He wanted to increase Social Security. He wanted to boost union rights. He wanted to raise taxes on the rich. He wanted work to be a national guarantee. Sanders stands for all of this. So, yes, 2020 is different than 1972, but in many ways, Sanders is running on a platform whose first draft, or maybe second draft after FDR, was written by George McGovern.
And why did McGovern lose so badly to Nixon?
The easiest answer to that question is it's because Richard Nixon was extremely popular in 1972. That's weird to think of in retrospect because we know what happened in his second term. But Nixon was a really popular president in 72. His approval rating for much of that year hovered in the mid-60s. Donald Trump's approval rating has not exceeded 50% since, I believe, his first or second month as president. So the incumbent in 72 was much stronger than the incumbent in 2020, and that is largely why McGovern lost. There's other reasons, like, for example, you had less polarization. So, in fact, you had a lot of Democrats move over and support Richard Nixon, who, in fact, was a rather liberal president given his Republican identification, at least compared to today. But most importantly, it's because Nixon was hugely popular while Trump is not.
So then is McGovern not a warning for Sanders supporters?
I think it's a complicated issue. I think that on the one hand, it's clear that lots of far-left candidates have run for president in the U.S., and they've all lost, unless they were running, arguably, in the middle of a Great Depression. And this hooks into a lot of public political science research that seems to indicate that far-left-wing or far-right-wing candidates tend to be riskier than moderates. At the same time, 2020 is really different than 72. There is more income inequality. There is more diversity. There are new changes to the electorate, like the gender gap, and women are almost certainly going to vote Democratic over Republican in 2020 by a historic margin. The country has moved to the left on a host of issues that McGovern himself championed, whether it was gay rights, healthcare itself, or income support for poor workers. So this is a really, really different year, and I think it's always risky to compare one year to something that happened 48 years ago. But history is, as Clyburn said, it can be instructive, so it's important to listen to both the rhymes while understanding the differences.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. We'll link you to his piece at hereandnow.org. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Tanya, can you believe it? We're almost here at Super Tuesday. And you were just in South Carolina the other day.
I know. And before you know it, it will be Wednesday morning.
That's right. We'll be here. Here Now, it's a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.